much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Welcome to one of the most unusual and inspiring shows on the radio, a show that shines a light on people living lives of purpose, passion, and adventure, and proves that, yeah, you can do it too. It's called Growing Bolder, and I'm Bill Schaefer with Mark Middleton. Just give us a few minutes and see for yourself, as you'll hear from renowned experts, best-selling authors, and seemingly ordinary people who are, in fact, living extraordinary lives.
As you know, Growing Bolder is a radio show, but it's also a TV show, a magazine, and a website, all offering hope, inspiration, and possibility. And today you'll meet a neuroscientist who can spot a lie from a mile away. Then we have one of New York's top hip-hop DJs, who just happens to be 66 years old, and the story of a 40-year-old who was just enrolled in medical school, proving that it's never too late even for that. But first, she's one of the brightest stars ever to come out of musical theater, Miss Cheetah Rivera. Amazing people, amazing stories. This is Growing Bolder.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down. And all that jazz.
The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest. You're listening to Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer along with Mark Middleton. And boy, our next guest is a national treasure. I know you hear that a lot, but boy, are we talking about a musical theater goddess who, after more than 65 years in show business, is still going strong. In fact, she's about to make her Carnegie Hall headlining solo debut with Cheetah Nowadays.
Yeah, I think you know who we're talking about. She's a 10-time Tony Award nominee, a 2-time Tony Award winner, the first Latina to receive a Kennedy Center honor, and in 2009, she was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the White House, along with Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, Senator Edward Kennedy, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. That's the way she rolls. Let's say hello to the one and only Cheetah Rivera. Hey, Cheetah, how are you?
Oh, well, I'm much better after hearing that. I was wondering who you were talking about there for a while.
Oh, you're so humble. What an honor it is for us. And let's start with Cheetah Nowadays, one night only, November 7th at Carnegie Hall. Tell us about Nowadays. You know, what will those fortunate enough to be in the audience get to see?
Well, I was asked to do it, and one always, you know, you say, how do I get the Carnegie Hall practice? Well, I've had a lot of time to practice, but Carnegie Hall is such a magnificent hall, and I've never played it. I think I did once when Lena Horne was being honored, but this is quite an honor for me, and I'm so excited about just that one. And I do love the title. You know, it just came out of my mouth one day. I said, you know, I think it would be a good idea to call it Nowadays, because I so live in the moment. I think we should live in the moment, and at this time in my life, Nowadays just sounds so good. I kind of like own it with Gwen. You know, but Freddie and John wrote it for Gwen and myself for the show Chicago, and it just seems full circle to use that title. I just love that. I'll have guests. I'll have a wonderful guy named Andy Carl and four of my extraordinary fellas that I dance with and have danced with for years. It'll be stories, it'll be dance numbers and songs, from the 250 years I've been in the business.
You touched on something really interesting there, Cheetah. So many people with all of the great things on their resume might have called their show Cheetah Yesterday, but you called it Nowadays. What is life like nowadays? Because really, you're setting the bar for other people to try to follow.
Well, you know what? That's what I think we owe to each other. You know, I think that's how we share our lives, our knowledge. That's why our teachers are so important. And I think we're all teachers. And when it just came out, it just blew my mind. And because it felt so right for the way I feel, I don't think you can get to tomorrow until you live now, you know. And I think I owe it to myself, and I owe it to those people that I've had so many great performers come up to me and say, you know, I don't think I thought I wanted to like stop and give it up. You know, I don't know what I want to do now. And now, after seeing the show, you and your show, I there's more I want to say. There's more I want to share. And that's good stuff.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America. For a small fee in America.
Folks, we're talking with Cheetah Rivera, and Cheetah, you played Anita in West Side Story, the original right. production back in 1957, Rosie in Bye Bye Birdie. You mentioned right. Velma in Chicago. Is there a role that you loved more than any others that you were most passionate about?
You know, it's very difficult. It's like somebody saying, you've got five kids, which one do you like best? I mean, it's so hard because they all have something amazing to offer. The story of Spider-Woman was extraordinary, you know, and I find, fortunately, that most of the shows that I do have a tremendous message, including the last one that I did called The Visit, which didn't last very long, but I think there's probably still some life in it, and it was very dark. But the subject matter was something to deal with that we all have to deal with. And but, you know, Spider-Woman and West Side, and unfortunately, you know, we're dealing with the same horrible problems with a lot of these shows. Spider-Woman was the difference between people and trying to understand each other without being frightened of one another. And West Side, the old Romeo and Juliet story, it's all fear, behind it all. And The Visit had an awful lot of that in it. So they have important subject matter that we need to deal with in our lives.
They're all about people overcoming obstacles.
That's right.
And we all have them. I know I've heard you talk before that sexism was never really something that affected you very much. How about ageism? Because so many people come on this program, actors and actresses, and say, boy, I mean, that your industry is really difficult on people as they age.
Well, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't have to deal with films and things like that. You know, it's the theater. And, you know, when we did Chicago, a long time ago, we had a reading and the first day, and then we were released for lunch, and then we came back from lunch, and Gwen was doing her crocheting that she had to learn how to do, and I was doing a couple of steps in the corner. We were told Bob Fosse had a heart attack. To make a long story short, he recuperated, and we all came back. But during the time that Bobby was sick, Fred Ebb, John Cantor, and Ron Field, who was a brilliant director, choreographer, cabaret, and a lot of other stuff, said, let's do a club act. Now, that's a long time ago. Now, because of that, I have the most wonderful pieces of material that Freddie and John have written for me throughout my career, and I am still, to this day, being able to do it because the material is so good. So, getting to what we were talking about, I can do a show, and then I can go across the country, like I will be doing in Erie, in Pennsylvania, a couple of weeks, and I'll be going to London to do my supper club. And that is just another way for me to express myself and meet new people and entertain new people. And so your life goes in different directions. I wouldn't change mine, you know, make it movies as opposed to theater. No, I wouldn't do that. Theater is my home, and I love it. And so when I'm not doing a show, I can do this thing that was created years ago by Fred Ebb and John Cantor.
Other than this amazing library of incredible work that you've given us over the past decades, Cheetah, what would you say is the moral of the Cheetah Rivera story? What's the takeaway? What can we learn from life that you've experienced?
I hope that I have, because I have experienced it, so I hope I give it back. Passion for life and for human beings, no matter who they are, what they've done, or just inspired, because I have been inspired by people, by all kinds of people. They've made me what I am today, and I'm hoping that I can do that for the young dancer or the young actor or the young anything or the older person who thinks their life is over with and they can't do anything. Of course they can. You just have to share it, care about it, and do it.
Quick follow-up on that. You have had so many successes. It would be so easy for you to sit back and look in the rearview mirror and kind of live your life through what you've done. What's it like at your age now as you look forward? Are you as optimistic, as excited about tomorrow as you are about yesterday?
I just do it. Yeah. The fact that I can get up and I can do, you know, what I have to do is, and it's just thrilling to me just to be able to live, you know, to be able to share. You know, I can't say, you know, I eat yogurt every day, you know, or whatever, you know. I can only say that I haven't let anything go by, you know. I love to laugh. I think laughter is vital. And I listen. I listen and I look. I use all the assets that God has given us, and you get things back. I mean, I never thought that I would play Carnegie Hall. I'm also not a dreamer. I don't dream. I'm a doer. I always said, you know, I think maybe the next life I'll come back being the cart, and the beautiful cart, instead of that horse. Because I'm that horse.
You know, so we look at your life, Cheetah, and we think, wow, it's, you know, what an amazing life she's had. But are there still things on your bucket list, so to speak? What does Cheetah Rivera really want to do?
I want this Carnegie Hall to be so much fun, so inspiring. So, I love what I do. I really do enjoy that laughter that comes from beyond the orchestra pit, that applause that comes beyond, that connection. I love being able to put the plug in and get the reaction right away. I like to share, so you can tell I'm not a loner. That's what keeps me there. That's what keeps me there. It's my way. It's all about communication. It's my way to communicate with the part of the world that I'm exposed to. I don't want a minute to go by without it being inspiring in some way, or enlightening in some way, or makes me smile. Or, you know, you go through the toll booth and the woman is looks so grumpy, and or you're feeling grumpy, and you go and you say hello, or they say hi, how are you, and suddenly, so it's all about communication.
And she has given us a better understanding of why she is one of the biggest stars from the golden age of Broadway, still delighting audiences to this day with her incredible talent and really inspiring all of us to believe that there is no expiration date on talent and passion. Cheetah, a legendary celebration. Her concert tour continues, and of course she's got her headlining show coming up at Carnegie. Folks, if you want to learn more, check out CheetahRivera.com. Cheetah, thanks so much.
I don't care about expensive things, cashmere coats, diamond rings, don't need a thing. All I care about is love.
Coming up, more proof that it's never too late. We'll meet a man who just started medical school at the age of 40. And wait till you find out why. This is Growing Bolder.
All I care about is love.
All she cares about is love.
Give me two.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder.
You're listening to Growing Boulder Radio with Mark and Bill. You know, it's never, never too late to live the life you really want, and we've got another great example.
Yeah, a guy who, like many of us, struggled to find out where he fit into life, a guy who never expected to be starting down the path of becoming a medical doctor.
Class members, today is your special day. In just a few moments, you will realize your dream of putting on your white coat for the first time.
At the age of 40, Eric Wilson had moved one step closer to his dream. He had just started medical school.
You ready for it?
No. And yes.
It's the last place his friends expected him to be, especially those in college with him his first time around.
I was very stubborn at that point in time. I kind of believed that no one had anything to teach me at all. And I probably viewed everything as the professor's fault. Like, oh, you don't get me, I know what I'm doing, which was apparently the totally wrong attitude, and didn't take long to drop out.
Eric had an attitude problem. He bounced from job to job, never quite fitting in.
I did that for about 2-3 years, struggling, flopping around, realizing I wasn't going anywhere. And then I realized I needed a strong change, a very strong change.
He chose an interesting place to make that change.
The Army. The Army kind of doesn't give you any flexibility. I mean, boot camp probably breaks that down and you're going to do what you're told and develop some skills.
He learned the hard way that excuses were pointless. It's all about results.
It's tough, 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 tough. You know, there's no points, no softness, no weakness. If someone's got a problem, you need to pick it up and keep going.
When an Army chaplain needed an assistant, Wilson volunteered, and that changed everything. His me against the world attitude didn't work anymore. As a chaplain's assistant, he had to listen and see things from the perspective of others, and that led to a revelation.
Now, what I realized most of the time, it's not the world that's not working, it's me. I'm the one not working. I'm the malfunctioning cog in the wheel. And you got to address that and make changes, or you're not going to survive in the world. You're going to fail.
Failure was not an option. He finally had a sense of purpose. He wanted to be a doctor, but he was already in his 30s.
But you're too old to do that.
Absolutely not.
It wouldn't be easy. Knowing what you want to do doesn't always mean you'll get the chance.
It took me 7 years to get my life in order. It wasn't that it was there. But, you know, being like a man in a mission to get his life together and get everything going, I came out of the Army. I was still in debt. You know, I had mortgage. I couldn't just go to school. I had to find work, and I had to reset my life to zero. Standing tall amid the fields. Look, that tractor has huge wheels.
He also had a wife and 2 young kids. His dream of becoming a doctor seemed a million miles away until he applied at the University of Central Florida College of Medicine.
UCF has this great vision, and a statement I heard when I'm speaking was, we want to develop the best you.
Yes.
Meaning they weren't pushing me necessary to be a physician research scientist or, you know, you must go into rural primary care. What is it you want to do? What is your dreams? Where do you want to go? What are your passions? What do you want to research? We got your back. This is where you want to go? Okay, go do it. And we're going to support you. And to me, that was everything I needed. At that statement, I remember interview day, on that statement, that shut everything else down. I was like, this is it. This is where I want to go.
Today, you walk onto the pages of UCF history and become a part of a proud tradition of excellence.
This is where I want to be. This is the community I want to help. And this is how I want to serve.
And as for how he's surviving and thriving?
I would think almost as my surviving is surviving who I was. I was going against myself. I was my biggest problem. And I was able to overcome myself and develop into becoming actually a good human being. And that's how I'm thriving. I'm continuing to put myself out there, getting new experiences, meet new people, and show, you know, teach me. I guess I'm the empty cup. Fill my cup with your knowledge.
Man, a very exciting, interesting, and inspiring story. And interesting, Bill, that before he did anything, he had to become, in his own words, a good human being.
Yeah, isn't that something to think of yourself, that you weren't high enough caliber, and now he wants to find a way to help other vets, and he wants to be thankful for the opportunity granted him by the UCF College of Medicine. Coming up, one of New York's top DJs, how that happened for him in his mid-60s. This is Growing Bolder.
It's on and on, and on and on, and on we go.
Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
You're listening to Growing Bolder Radio. Bill Schaefer here with Mark Middleton. We talk about this a lot. We wonder, whatever happened to the hippie generation? All those kids with the high ideals and hopes for changing society to a kinder and gentler one that was full of support and encouragement for everyone to do their thing.
Yeah, things didn't exactly go the way many had hoped, although there are some from that era who are now living out their later years and doing exactly that, and we're going to talk to one of them right now. This is a guy who spent his early years putting on hundreds of concerts back in the 60s in San Francisco, and now at the age of 66, he is back to doing what he loves the most. He is immersed in the music. Let's learn more as we say hello to Larry Preschool Weissman. Hey, Preschool, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
We're doing great. Tell us about the name, Preschool. Where did that come from?
Well, when I started DJing, obviously I was a lot older than most of the other kids that were DJing. And my breadth of musical knowledge is pretty deep since I think the first concert I ever went to was the Beach Boys and the Shirelles back in 1962. So it kind of, a lot of my friends would say to me, you know, Jesus, like before there was old school or new school, there was preschool. So that's kind of how it came up.
So Larry, sounds like you had an amazing youth or teen years, and then life happened to you. I guess you had to make a living, and you did great. You moved up to like vice president of technology for Wells Fargo. What would the 18-year-old Larry Weissman have thought of that guy?
Well, I've often wondered about that. I mean, you know, all of us back then, we had a lot of ideals, and well, we tried our best, and you know, and I think a lot of those ideals are still out there. But like you said, I had to find a way to support myself and my sons. So, you know, I feel like I always did an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, and I don't really have any regrets on it. I was able to raise a really good kid who's now married and, you know, he's in his 40s himself. So, you know, basically I feel pretty good about it. And all along I kept my love of music. And unfortunately I've been able to expand on that once I left the bank.
And that is what we love about your story, because we often talk to people about reconnecting with the passions of their youth. Many just cannot do that. They get on this corporate trajectory, and then they get into a typical retirement. As you close in on your retirement age, you make what is a radical decision. Pretty much you dropped out. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I was very fortunate to I moved to Williamsburg, Brooklyn, back in the late 90s as I was working at the bank. And I made a lot of friends that were musicians and artists and so on. And I kind of on the side started to learn how to DJ and, you know, did a little DJing as a hobby. Then as I got close to retirement, I realized that I'm not the kind of person that just wants to go, like, play golf or, like, hang out or, you know, something like that. I really wanted to find something I could throw myself into. And I had been pretty successful in my DJing at that point, so I decided to retire from the bank and become a full-time DJ and music producer. I went to DJ school. They have a really good one here in New York City, Dubspot. Spent about a year really learning the craft, and since then it's been tremendous. I get a tremendous response from people. I think that the main reason I really like it is that I DJ house music, which is extremely popular with kids, and the crowd of people that come to see me are all young, and it really gives me a chance to connect with people around something that we all share and love, which is music and dancing, which is what I was doing when I was 18. So it's a pretty good thing. It definitely makes me feel younger and keeps me younger.
Larry, what was it like for you to go to DJ school? First of all, you had to have pretty much courage to go. And secondly, I'm guessing you were the oldest guy there by far. How did that interaction work out?
Well, I have to say that the kids were absolutely tremendous. I mean, one thing about DJing is it's all around a shared passion for music. So it was absolutely tremendous. I never once felt like I was, anyone was resentful of me being there. I had nothing but support from both the teachers who were all DJs themselves. And believe me, I was older than all the teachers there too. But everybody was super supportive, and it was just an absolutely tremendous experience. If there's one thing I've learned from that is if you have a desire or something, it's a good thing to try to make it happen, and you might be surprised how warm and welcoming people can be.
Folks, we're talking to DJ Larry Preschool Weissman, who, after he retired from a corporate career with Wells Fargo Bank, went back to the passion of his youth, became a DJ, and is now working and having the time of his life. And it's great that the younger people have accepted you, preschool, but do they fully understand what you bring to the party? I imagine they don't understand that you hung out with the Beach Boys, and I'll bet you even saw Jimi Hendrix play in San Francisco back in the day.
Yeah, I think what people sense is that I've been through so many changes of the music scene, and I kind of see the connections between them. It is pretty amazing. A lot of times when I try to spin music from the 80s and the 90s and kind of mix it in with new music, even some music from the 60s. And I think nowadays people are just much more open and receptive to seeing music as a continuum, and not so much split up. It's amazing, particularly really young. I mean, kids in their 20s they have so much access to music. They're very open to things in a way I think that even we probably weren't when I was 18. I was pretty much of a hardcore rock and roller. I don't want to hear about anything else, but they're a lot more open than me.
You know, Larry, it seems like those of us in this generation were there from the beginning of rock all the way to now, and we all look down at everybody else's music. You say you play house. Do you like it?
Yeah, I do. I really like it. I think that you know, what I've learned over the years is that genre really isn't a good way to look at music. What you have to look at is it good, and does it make you feel good, and does it speak to you? And house music has been around now since the 80s, and just like rock, it's developed and it's become somewhat more sophisticated, and there's a tremendous amount of energy in it, and I think it's also a very positive music as opposed to a lot of genres that are negative, and to my mind, you know, that's one of the key things I like about it, is that I want people to come, and when they hear me, to leave feeling really good and thinking about the commonalities we have between us. There's so much darkness in the world. I feel like in the time I have left, I want to bring light to people as much as possible.
And what a better guy to do it. I mean, Larry, the career that you've had when you were young sounded fascinating, and you're back at it again. You're teaching without having to preach to younger people how cool people of age and experience can be, and how much better it is for everybody when we share.
The key point too is, like, I'm not the kind of person, I don't believe in this stuff when I tell people, oh, we had it great in the old days. It's really a question of showing them by showing them that, you know, you can, if you believe in something and you really want to do it, you can do it, and it can be a good thing. And it's kind of like leading by example, and it's been great. I mean, the relationships and the support and love I get from the kids when I'm DJing is just fantastic. And I think part of it is them seeing that, like, as you get older, you don't have to compromise and settle necessarily, you know, as you go through life.
He is the hippest and best DJ going today, never mind the oldest, proven that it is never too late to live your life to the fullest. Our thanks to DJ Larry Preschool Weissman. Coming up, how to find the truth in an endless stream of misleading and manipulated information. This is Growing Bolder.
We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
This is Growing Bolder. I'm Bill Schaefer, and we're about to blow the roof off everything you believe. Like, did man really land on the moon? Is Elvis still alive? Every day on the internet, we all read stories, memes, and quotes, and we wonder, could this be true? Well, we're about to find out. Our next guest is an award-winning neuroscientist and the author of the best-selling, mind-blowing books, This Is Your Brain on Music and The Organized Mind This Time. He's here to help us fight our way through a forest of misleading, manipulated information with his latest, A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Let's welcome Daniel J. Levitin. How are you, Daniel?
I'm good, Bill. How are you?
Great to have you here, because this has become an epidemic. How do we even know who to believe anymore?
Well, it's getting harder and harder, isn't it? In the old days, you knew that if you read it in a supermarket tabloid and you didn't hear it on NPR or read it in a respectable newspaper, it was unlikely to be true. You couldn't know for sure, but it was unlikely, right? Now, because most of us get our news from the internet, and increasingly people under the age of 25 are getting all their news from Facebook, it's harder to tell, because you don't have the clues, the visual clues that tell you, well, this might not really be true.
Yeah, getting their news from Facebook, that in itself is terrifying. And the reason that we were really attracted to your book is it reminds me of a fitting quote that I did see on the internet. It said, you can't believe everything you read. And that quote, of course, was from Abe Lincoln, who said, you can't believe everything you read on the internet.
Honest Abe, telling it like it is.
But you see that stuff all the time. So where do we go to seek the truth? It used to be, like you said, NPR, maybe even encyclopedias. Now it's Snopes, and who even knows if that's true?
Well, right. It's getting harder and harder. But, you know, it used to take us anywhere from hours to days to get new information. You'd have to trot on down to a library and find it. The nice thing about libraries is, of course, they were curated. People people with information science degrees would make decisions about what would go in the library. Now anybody can start an internet site, anybody can do a Facebook post, and they can say anything. So with the time we saved in not having to trot down to the library, I think each of us has to invest a little bit of that in some critical thinking skills, basic critical thinking skills, like is this claim even plausible? Who said it? Are they using weasel words? For example, right before you and I got on, I heard a radio advertisement that this breakfast cereal was the highest rated cereal. So that's kind of loose language. When I hear loose language, I want to ask, highest rated by whom? Who rated it? And what did they rate it for? Is it rated for taste? Is it rated for tasting awful? Was this the highest rated breakfast cereal for lacking nutritional value? If somebody isn't precise, there might be a reason.
Right. Now it's 50% better.
Right. Right. And, you know, this touches on a number of issues. I'm not just talking about interpreting headlines, but if you read about a medication you can take that, you know, will reduce by half your risk of having a heart attack or, you know, something like that. Well, what was your risk beforehand? Mm. If your risk was only 1 in 10 million and you're reducing it to 1 in 5 million, maybe it's not worth it. Maybe it's not worth the potential side effects.
So is what you're trying to say is that aliens did not land at Roswell and there wasn't a second gunman on the grassy knoll? Is that your point?
Well, I can't say that for sure. I don't really know. But I can say it seems unlikely.
You know, as you started to mention too, Daniel, we're talking to Daniel J. Levitin, who's written this great new book called A Field Guide to Lies, because we're exposed to so much manipulation. And it's not just in commercials, but it's also things like persistent, ominous rumors that just won't go away. For instance, the controversy, and it's a big one, about childhood vaccines causing autism.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. There's this phenomenon that we cognitive scientists have identified called belief perseverance. The idea is that once you come to hold a belief, it perseveres in your mind, and it's very hard to unseat it, even in the face of information that contradicts it directly, or even when you find out the original evidence that led you to that conclusion was faulty. And this hasn't played out any more vividly than in the measles MMR vaccine autism link, or I should say false link. The guy who found a link, Andrew Wakefield, has been thoroughly discredited. He's lost his medical license. He's been censured. He's admitted to fabricating data. And beyond that, lots of studies have been conducted, and nobody has found a link. Now, this doesn't mean a link doesn't exist, but there is still, just because, you know, you don't find something doesn't mean it doesn't exist. But it's looking increasingly unlikely, wildly unlikely. It just so happens that some kids who got the vaccine got autism, but not in greater numbers than you would have expected if they didn't get the vaccine.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Sometimes these quote-unquote manipulations happen on purpose, and sometimes they're totally unintentional, like perhaps newspapers and TV news used to strive to actually report a story, not just rewrite a press release. They would never take information at face value in the past. But now, intentional or not, sometimes we are just fed information. It's just passed along because it's in some report.
Well, and that's not journalism anymore, right? I mean, journalism, like the law and like science, has a set of tenets and principles that it takes a while to learn to get to the heart of a story, and that means fact-checking and, you know, who told you this, and are they reliable, and can you get some second and third opinions to back it up? The responsibility of a free press in a free society is enormous because they help to keep, you know, the public discourse honest. And fortunately, a lot of journalists and a lot of outlets have stepped up to the challenge. We've got PolitiFact now and other fact-checking sites that dedicate themselves to picking apart what political candidates say to see whether they're true or not.
Yeah, it really is interesting how the places that we used to count on are kind of eroding. So with all that in mind, what's the takeaway? What do you hope we learn from your research and your experiences in putting this book together?
Well, I think the takeaway is that I wouldn't say our brains are lazy, but they evolved to take shortcuts and to make snap decisions, because over evolutionary timescales, you know, the kinds of problems that we faced, like a charging lion or something, you know, snap decisions were necessary. But we're living in safer and more civilized times, and we need to slow down a bit and ask ourselves, is this really true? How do I know this? Am I believing something that isn't true? And all of us, starting at the age of 12, I think, need to be schooled in some basic principles of information literacy that I don't think take more than a couple of hours to read about.
Well, the book is called A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age, and it is now 10% better than any other book you've ever read. You can take our word for that. Our thanks to Daniel J. Levitin. And folks, don't believe everything you hear. Coming up, what are you going to be doing when you're 85 years old? We'll talk with the oldest man ever to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. This is Growing Boulder. Stay connected to Growing Boulder for daily doses of hope, inspiration, and possibility. Find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for our latest stories and motivational pictures. Listening to Growing Boulder, I'm Bill Schaefer along with Mark Middleton, and as you know, we are all about sharing examples of ordinary people living extraordinary lives, and Mark, Bob Wheeler certainly qualifies for that.
Yeah, he really does, Bill, because he says himself he's not a special person, he has no special athletic abilities, but yet he is the oldest man in history to climb Mount Kilimanjaro, which is the world's highest freestanding mountain at nearly 20,000 feet. He reached the summit in October of 2014 at the age of 85 years, 201 days. Let's welcome the adventurer, the mountaineer, the record holder, Mr. Bob Wheeler. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you.
You know what? We love your story because you are a guy who seems to refuse to get gobbled up by the couch. You've had both knees and both shoulders replaced, and yet you're still climbing mountains. What's your motivation?
Well, it's to demonstrate that older people do not have to become couch potatoes. They can reach out for new adventures, despite all of the aches and pains of growing old, worn-out muscles, deteriorated joints, it can be a challenge.
You know, Bob, that's a unbelievably inspiring mission. But isn't it kind of overkill? I mean, why mountains? Why not just walk around the mall a few times and prove that?
Well, that's not very. It can be challenging, but. There has to be something bigger and better, something beyond everyday activities. This is sort of the essence of staying active, both psychologically and physically, is reaching out to new adventures.
So tell us a little bit about the last night, if you will, because I understand it's about 9 hours to reach the summit from high camp. How grueling was that for you?
It was quite. Very difficult. And yes, the tradition at Kilimanjaro is to make that last climb to the summit during the nighttime. And I asked them why we do it at night. It'd be much better in the daytime when you can see what's going on. So they said, well, that's one of the disadvantages, because when people can see up ahead where they're having to go, they get discouraged. And when they can see behind where they've been, they get scared. So being in the dark has some advantages. But it was tough. Using headlamps, we could only see what our feet were doing. And towards the latter part of the climb, I didn't know if I was going to make it, because I couldn't breathe. My legs were aching, I was tired, and I was about to give out when all of a sudden the sky started getting lighter, and there we were on the rim of the volcano. You know, Kilimanjaro is a volcano, and the major thing is to get to the rim of the volcano. That's not the summit, because then it takes another hour or two of climbing to get from that point up to the summit.
You know, Bob,
but it was tough.
For all that you went through and all the neat experiences, I'm guessing one of the best, one of the most memorable, is the fact that your son was with you on that expedition. Can you talk about, boy, what that meant to him and what that meant to you to be able to accomplish this together?
Well, it was interesting. My son is an old Navy man and is interested in these sorts of things. We have climbed several mountains together before, the most notable one being Aconcagua down in Argentina. You know, that's the tallest mountain in the Western Hemisphere, the tallest mountain outside of the Himalayas. So it is quite a privilege and joy to have one son going along with him.
Folks, we're talking with Bob Wheeler, who is now 87 years old, and at the age of 85, he became the oldest man in history to summit Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania. And Bob, we actually spoke with a guy by the name of Dr. Paul Magelli on this program not long ago who was sizing up your record. He was going to make a run for it, but then he had some cardiac issues and had to cancel his trip. Are you worried that your record might be broken, or do you hope that someday some man will break it?
Well, as a matter of fact, it probably will be. As a matter of fact, I know one climber who has been asking me questions about the trip. He's a few months older than I am, so he will probably break my record. However, I've been talking with my son and also the guide that had over there in when I was 85. I'm planning on doing it again when I'm 90 years old.
What?
You know, one of our presidents skydived out of an airplane on his 90th birthday, and I figure, well, what I'll do is cement my record holding and climb Kilimanjaro when I'm 90 years old.
Well, see, his feat only took 30 seconds. Yours is going to take a week of grueling physical activity.
Well, I'm not too sure what you're saying, but
all he had to do was not bounce off the ground. You actually have to do something amazing. And speaking of amazing, I think we should mention you're a retired professor of psychology at St. Louis U, and you wrote a book called Mountains and Minds. What's that about?
Well, it's about why people do these silly things. My work in psychology and my previous career in the military made me quite interested in why people do some of the silly things that they do. It's basic human motivation. And mountains can symbolize overcoming obstacles and barriers that one encounters in daily life, because it seems it's very important for people to recognize that there's something bigger and better going on, rather than just struggling for their daily existence.
Well, Bob, you are an incredible inspiration to all of us, which is why we wanted to get you on. You show us what is possible, especially for someone that just keeps on keeping on. Is there a Bob Wheeler takeaway? Is there a moral to your story? Is there something that you want our listeners to learn that you have learned about life in general?
Well, yes, that's the purpose of my book, and incidentally, I'm trying to put together another edition to it, and that was the main reason that I went to Kilimanjaro. I needed another mountain climbing story for the new book. But yes, the moral is that people have to look outside of themselves, a little bit beyond their current viewpoint, because there's something bigger and better than just struggling with daily existence.
That is a great moral, folks. It comes from Bob Wheeler, and Bob has just told us he's broken some news here. When he's 90, he is going to try to extend his record, and you women are going to like this. The actual oldest person ever to climb Mount Kilimanjaro is not Bob Wheeler. It's a Russian woman by the name of Angela Vorobeva at 86 years old. So, Bob, go get her record, because we want Growing Boulder Radio Show guests to hold the record, because Angela won't talk to us.
Now, before we go, Mark, how about we leave everybody with a takeaway? Ever wonder why some people get all the breaks? Well, here's the answer. They don't. The difference is when an opportunity arises, they go for it. You see, opportunities are just like snowflakes. If you wait too long, they disappear. You have to be ready to jump, to take a chance, and watch your life change for the better. And that's what we call Growing Bolder.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula. And our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, blowing high and mighty traps. Countless fires.